Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 184th edition of the Frank and Stan Chat. And I'm delighted to say we have a guest with us, Neil Sheldon, who lives quite close to where I live, but I don't actually, we haven't actually met in person. We may have passed each other on the road, but anyway, he lives quite close to me, and we'll introduce Neil in a moment, but we'll go to Stan. As you can see, Stan, I'm not so well this week. I've got an inflamed eye, and to ensure that we carried on with the Frankenstein chat, we're going to record it today. I know. Anyway, how are you, Stan?
I'm fighting fit compared to you. I'm waiting for your answer in what caught my eye. It'll be
an infection. I don't know. I had something like this. I remember. About 6 months ago, we went on a walk in North Wales, and it was very windy, and the wind caught my eye, and you know, in a way, it made it sort of weepy, and I thought, oh well, this has come back again, but this feels quite different to that, but just can't get rid of it. But anyway, Neil, hello. So do you want to just introduce yourself and say who you are and what interests you and this sort of stuff?
I'm quite old. I've been in education really rather a long time. Amazingly, at least amazes me, it's over 50 years that I've been working in education. My academic background is, I suppose, a bit mixed. I started out in mathematics. I then became a philosopher, later a statistician, a computer scientist, a data scientist, and then into linguistics. And I've done research level work in both philosophy and statistics. I've taught at ages 9 to 90, literally, school, college, university level, teachers, professional development. I've been an examiner at various levels for getting on for 50 years. I've worked in quality assurance in exams for QCA and its forerunner bodies for a long time. I'm currently on a Royal Society ACME committee that looks at the quality of examinations. I'm a chartered statistician, former vice president of the Royal Statistical Society, and I'm still working. I'm currently a visiting lecturer in statistical communication at Helsinki University. I do a lot of work still in teachers' professional development. I'm chair of the Teaching Statistics Trust. I'm vice chair of the UK Linguistics Olympiad, taken the linguistics team most years over the last 12 years to the international event where we've had huge levels of success. And by way of light relief, I present shows on early jazz on internet radio.
Blooming heck. Honestly, Stan, how in heaven's name did Frankenstein chat get involved with such eminent people? We had this, was it last week? We had a guest on, and we have guests on quite regularly, and it's just, I mean, I think we think we're busy.
So what do you do in your spare time?
That's why I don't see you walking around the streets. You haven't got time for it, Neil.
The domestic duties, the hoovering and the washing up. Actually, I mean, there is spare time. I'm only back a few days ago from a cruise in the Caribbean. So, you know, there is room for holidays.
Yeah, good.
Wow.
It's very nice.
Wow. I mean, we spoke before the recording about accuracy in education, and I know that I think it was a colleague that who connected us together, who has a particular interest in the accuracy of our examination system, and is disputing the sort of apparent message that all grades are accurate, you know, or at least virtually all of them, and he's, you know, obviously Dennis Sherwood is disputing that, but I think it was through Dennis that you were connected to us. So how do you know Dennis, and How does that your thinking influence his thinking, and where is it all heading in terms of accuracy of education data?
Yeah, well, that's a very big, very interesting question. How did it all start? Well, Dennis contacted the Royal Statistical Society saying that he had this concern about the accuracy of grading. Was there anybody there who was able to help, able to get involved? I was at that time vice president for education, so it naturally came my way. I got in touch with Dennis and talked to him about his concerns, and in particular about the publications that were in the public domain that indicated that Dennis had a point. Now, the point that Dennis had was that grades were unreliable, and his suggested way forward would be to say, very roughly speaking, grades are only reliable to within plus or minus one grade. So maybe what we need to do is give everybody the benefit of the doubt and give everybody one grade higher than their mark seems to warrant. Well, it took a bit of persuasion on my part to say to Dennis that, or to convince Dennis that all that we'd be doing then would be moving the goalposts. We wouldn't actually be changing anything. We'd just be labeling everything with a plus one. Anyway, we've, I think, evolved a position where what we now agree is that, and this is a much more important point, that actually, because it applies so broadly in statistics, that we shouldn't be pretending that we can make a precise measurement at the level of a grade anyway. If what we said was, here is a mark based on the scripts that the candidate submitted, but that mark cannot be precise. It has to be interpreted with a plus or minus around it. And the plus or minus would depend on the subject. You know, in mathematics, where the marking is so much more precise, you could have a very small margin of error, whereas in a subject like history or English, essay-based, you'd want a rather larger margin of error. If we could move to that, then we would avoid having this sort of cliff edge threshold of grade boundaries. Now, I think Dennis is now of the view that that is, in fact, a possible way forward, but it does require that we educate the general public to interpret results like that. And I'm afraid the general public, not their fault, it's the way they've been taught and trained, want precision,
Precision.
even in areas where precision doesn't actually exist.
Now, Stan, this is really at the heart of the data that we have on schools, isn't it? Because this, we talk here about the accuracy of the grades and all that at GCSE, because that data is then used by government to determine how much progress children have made over a certain period of time. And it was interesting. I shared an article I wrote, or a draft I wrote yesterday with Stan, where I was chatting to a quite eminent statistician who's involved in education research, who said, well, basically, education research, education data is just too flaky. It's not reliable enough. And in terms of talking about comparing schools, for example, secondary schools, where there's perhaps 3,400 of them, as a group of schools, that's simply insufficient in number to be able to sort of come up with a, in most cases, he was saying, a fairly accurate assessment of how much progress children in particular schools made. So really he was saying that outliers are outliers, and they sit outside and that something strange has happened there. But the bulk of these schools sit somewhere lumped in the middle. And because of the confidence you have in the data, it's difficult to say that one school has performed significantly better than another. It is if you go to the single number, if you go to the center point in terms of that. But actually, the confidence intervals are much wider than that. So, for me, we suffer in education with the same problem. The interpretation is, and people's careers are falling and succeeding on the basis of some pretty flaky data. And trustees, governors, a lot's made of that, and I think that there's real risks involved for senior leaders here.
And don't forget, Frank, in primary, some of that data is based on about 30 individuals.
Yes.
And that's interpreted to potentially teachers and head teachers' jobs on the results of 30, and comparing one year's with another when it's a completely different
Yeah,
cohort
a
with
different
no
cohort.
connection.
Yeah.
I've always found it really, really strange that we rely on those figures as much as we do. But they, as you've said, that they're in the public domain now as accurate figures, as real statistics, and it'd be very difficult, I think, to undo that in the public mind.
Yeah, I mean there is a danger, and it's not just in education; it's everywhere that numbers pop up that people have one or two reactions when they see a number. Some people see it and say, "Oh, that must be definitive. That must be right. I believe it." And other people just put blinkers on and say, "I don't do numbers. I don't want anything to do with it at all." And what you don't very often get, but what we need, is somebody who can essentially build up the story behind the numbers and actually understand what's driving the numbers that you've got. And really, really importantly, people who are able to understand that every number, every measurement you come up with will have some sort of uncertainty around it, and knowing what the margin of error is likely to be is absolutely key to interpreting the data.
See,
My favourite, sorry Frank, my
go on.
favourite is a school I was an advisor to in Lancashire when we were doing target setting, and we had to agree that their target for level four, it was at the time, and above, would be zero, which when I entered that into the data, my line manager jumped all over me saying, "You can't have a school setting zero. Whatever you do, they must set a target. You can't set zero as a target." And I said, "But they have no children in that cohort. It's a school of 38 children. There are no, well, they might get one." So I said, "Well, if they get one, then the target will be 100%. So you can either have 100% or not. You can't have any figure in between."
Is it? I'm just fascinated with this idea of confidence intervals, and margin of error. I think because I think this is very much around how children and are taught at school that in effect they're taught things that are accurate, or they believe them to be accurate. Like just simple addition, multiplication. There is an answer that everybody accepts that's the answer. So I think people get to a position where they view mathematics, even just the interpretation, as an accurate process. And the point you made before, GCSE mathematics, there's the margin of error in terms of the grading is less, but it's still not infallible. So do you think that's probably where the root of the problem rests, or am I just sort of trying to make it easy for me to understand rather than anything
No,
else?
I think you're right, and I think that, and I can speak as somebody with mathematics in his background, I think mathematicians have a lot to answer for here. When I'm addressing groups of mathematics teachers, as I do quite a lot, but doing so as a statistician, I quite often come up with the line, "I used to be a pure mathematician, but I grew out of it." I don't much care to hear me say that, and I get some sharp looks, but I'm actually quite serious. Pure mathematics is about precision. The real world isn't. So therefore, pure mathematics is not about the real world. And what I'm trying to do as a statistician is to say, once we start transferring to the real world, we have to accept that pure mathematics doesn't do the job, that what we have to do is build in some understanding of uncertainty in everything that we do. I mean, a little anecdote on this. I've said already that I've done a lot of work in essentially quality control and examinations. And I remember very well one particular occasion when we were looking at a statistics question, the details of which don't matter, but the final part of the question said, "Do you think the assumptions that are necessary for you to make in this question are right or wrong?" And the mark scheme gave two possibilities, right and wrong. And one of the mathematicians in the audience said, "There's a mistake in the mark scheme. Both answers are correct. This cannot be, you know." And obviously, you had to justify why you said it was right. You had to justify why you said they were wrong. It wasn't just a matter of writing down the answer right, wrong. You had to explain what your thinking was. But this pure mathematician couldn't cope with the idea that either answer was correct.
Right.
said, well, you know, think about other subjects. Was Henry VIII a good king? You know, there isn't a simple yes or no answer. You come up with a position and you defend it. And statistics is like that as well. I do or do not think these assumptions are reasonable based on what I know about the real world. And a pure mathematician at this point say, the real world, what's that got to do with anything? You know, I'm trying to get precise answers to arithmetical questions. It's a just a totally different outlook.
It's
And there
funny
is real
that does.
problem in this
I'm
country.
satisfied actually. You don't realize I wrote that piece for Stan yesterday, based on really. I think it's around the sort of issue you're talking about here. I think where I was sort of s saying that things like, and we're going to probably get onto it in a minute about the closure of Sure Start centres, and actually I think everybody in the country probably thought Sure Starts, given time. And you know, and the right level of support are probably going to work. They're probably going to have a positive impact. There was a hunch, you know, based on some, you know, experience. It may perhaps less on the data, but more on a philosophical thing about how young people, you know, learn and how families connect with each other. But actually, data then was used to suggest that it wasn't working. You know, it was used as in a negative way. And actually, I think that. That was an, I think, an ideological decision was made. You know, the Department for Education became the Department for Education. It didn't want to be children and families. You know, so family children's centres was at the heart of the children and families, you know, department. You know, so it had to be about education. So one of the what went were the children's centres. They were starved of funding, but actually at the heart of it was just a sense of, you know, we didn't really need the data. You know, there was something happening that you could actually see. The data was like a negative thing that was used to sort of criticize it. But those centres were never given enough time to
I was
really
going to say,
blossom and grow.
used too early and not allowed the concept to mature, so you could actually see what the impact was at later stages in children's lives.
Yeah, and there is the danger. I don't know to what extent it applies with the Sure Start Centre, but there's the danger of saying unless we can measure it, it can't be a real phenomenon. Which
Yes.
I completely and utterly reject that. I'll give you an anecdote, if I may. It goes back to my teaching pupils of the age of 9, and it was a course that I ran for a couple of years for children from deprived backgrounds in the Manchester area, Saturday mornings, 2 hours, doing mathematics. Now, I had a very good level of attendance across the 2 years that I ran the course. Pretty much everybody who signed up stuck with it. These are children getting out of bed on a Saturday morning in order to come and do extra mathematics. And at the end of the 2 years, the body that was funding it said, we can't continue to do this unless we have some measure of its effectiveness. And I said, what more measure of effectiveness do you want than that people are signing up, young people, 9-year-olds are signing up for a course that gets them out of bed on a Saturday morning and they stick with it all the way from September through to Easter. What more do you want? And they
Yes.
said, we want an input measure and an output measure. I said, I resign. And I did. But I'm not prepared to do it. These children do not deserve to be tested when they're actually volunteering to do all this extra mathematics.
I can remember talking to the
Do you
TF
know, Neil? Yeah, go on.
when we were doing a project on trying to get children to enjoy school more, and we were talking to head teacher about how they might do that, and the TES said, "But how are you going to measure it?" And in anger, I suppose, I said, "We're going to measure the smiles at the start of the week and at the end of the week, and if they're broader smiles, we're going to count that as a win."
It's interesting, just this is a hunch. But you sort of feel as though, well, you know, there is this sort of apparent crisis around attendance. You know, children don't want to, you know, struggling to get to school, and you think, well, you know, perhaps it's just as simple as, you know, is school welcoming enough? You know, it is what we're teaching. I was really struck there, Neil, by the fact that you didn't say, I did the Saturday morning sessions in order to get them a grade A at GCSE. That might be a product of it. But that wasn't the reason why you did it. You know, you had a genuine interest in mathematics They were interested in mathematics. They showed their commitment to it by coming to you on a Saturday morning. The same thing is, why are some of the children not wanting to attend school? And no one's thinking, I don't hear people talking about, well, we might have created a curriculum here that might be very good at passing exams, but it's not particularly interesting for some of the kids who are not interested in passing exams. You know, I mean,
I mean, this course for my 9-year-olds, and incidentally, I've run other courses for other age groups with the same strapline. The strapline was, nothing that I do in these lessons will ever come up in any of your exams.
we need more educators like you, Neil. Oh, God.
And it worked. As you said, the smiles on their faces, the fact that they stuck with it. I need no other measure than that.
You know, I feel honestly, Neil, I mean, I've spoken to Neil a couple of times on Zoom, but every time there's just added value, added insight, you know, whether it's because it makes me feel better, because it's sort of, these are things that are going on in my head as well, and you're able to articulate it really well. I just think, oh my goodness. You know,
Well, pick up on something you were saying about absence. This is one of the things been in the news this week. And one of the things that struck me about that was that the analysis was in terms of persistent absence. That was the terminology used, persistent absence. And this is another of the big drivers for me and what I do. It's the language that's used in statistics. So I hear about the problem with a certain proportion of children being persistently absent. And I say to myself, I don't know what that means. I don't know what persistent absence actually means. So I look it up and I find out that persistent absence is absence for 10% or more of school sessions, unless you're in Wales where it's 20% or more, apparently. Do I
Yes.
believe that? I'm not sure.
It
But
used to
that's
be
the thing I find out.
20% in England as well.
It's what, sorry?
It used to be
It
20% in
used,
England.
well, okay, so this makes the point rather nicely for me. I am not actually closely involved with school attendance, never have been, because I've actually never worked in a school where it was an issue. But I read this as, if you like, a layperson, and I do not know what persistent absence actually means. I actually saw the BBC 2 or 3 days ago did a news feature on this, and they referred to the number of children being persistently absent, and they also referred to the number of children being absent for 10% or more of the time. They didn't say that is what persistent absence is. It was presented as, well, there's another way of looking at it. But it's actually the same thing. But I didn't know that. And furthermore, on the language, if I said that something happened persistently, I don't think I would mean it happens about 10% of the time. Persistently to me means, well, it's at least 50% of the time, So the very language that's being used is, I think, almost systematically, almost deliberately misleading. It doesn't actually do the job. Why can't we just say that a certain proportion of children are absent for a certain proportion of time?
Time.
And then even that leads to yet another thing, which is that we don't want a single figure that sums up the whole of an issue. So the persistent absence rate in the school is only one dimension of the problem. If you looked at the total absence across the school, across all pupils in the school, across the whole of a year group, you couldn't calculate that from the persistent absence rate.
No.
But not, the two just don't relate closely enough.
Yes.
And sure enough, I found when I was looking into this that there is another measure. I can't remember exactly what it's called. It might be called the chronic absence rate. I'm not sure. And that is actually the total absence rate across all pupils across the whole school. Totally different way of looking at it. This sort of thing bedevils statistics. You try to reduce things down to single figures, you don't explain the terminology properly, and what you're doing is you're missing the bulk of the issue because you've oversimplified and at the same time obfuscated what you're doing.
And that, of course, nobody explains who might be persistently absent. For instance,
Well,
children with medical issues who,
or
have to
parents
put.
who run shops. I mean, I mean, for somebody like me who's done a lot of work in Blackpool, you know, families running businesses, shops, retail, they have to take time out when their business is quiet, and it's generally quieter during term time. What you don't want to do is actually close your business when the town is full of tourists. So those children might take 2 weeks holiday with their parents against the law, but actually I fully understand the reasons why they do it, because they can't take a holiday at any other time with the family. But that will count towards their persistent absence. So it really does, it does my head in really when I think about sort of tourist places like Bournemouth, like Great Yarmouth, like Blackpool, where, what a family's meant to do, that are running businesses that are based on tourist trade. When I just, it just, we have a sort of system where we're judging persistence absence without actually considering the context behind the decisions that are being made. Those are children that are not bunking off school. They're just going on holiday with their
I
family.
think that's the impression, Frank, isn't it? The impression is these are children who are deciding themselves not to go to school, and we must do something about it. We must force them to go to school. It's like people who are not working. We've got to force them to work because they're not working.
That's a very topical point, isn't it, Stan?
Well.
Well done. Well, gosh, honestly, Neil, I will be, I'll be promoting this video more than I do most weeks, I tell you. I found, it's just fascinating. I think what I find, it's just the clarity of your explanations that cut through for me.
Yeah, I've been here for a long time.
I ought to do less talking and be more clear, I think. Anyway, Stan, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, funnily enough, this links directly to it, and that's the government's view that they will not change the one word overall judgment in Ofsted inspections, and the reason being that the government view is it's preferable to have those views, decisions, and consequences linked directly to an independent overall finding rather than interpretation by civil servants, politicians, and the media looking through the narrative of reports and drawing their own conclusions. What does that actually mean? It means that the average person, even the average civil servant, can't read an Ofsted report and come to the same conclusion necessarily that the inspector's done, which means the reports are badly written. It doesn't mean that we need to rely on a single judgment. It means that the report does not always match the overall judgment. And then to compound my annoyance, they then talk about one of the reasons is that we're able to say that 9 in 10 schools are either good or outstanding. Well, you've just put those two judgments, those two single things that you've said are really important for parents to be able to judge the difference, you've put them into one. So good and outstanding now is a band. So you don't need both good and outstanding. You just need meets the standards. And if we had schools that met the standards, schools that didn't quite meet the standards, and schools that didn't meet the standards, supported with a scorecard that makes it impossible to misread, then that's a much fairer, I think, way.
Well,
And
it's
for those
interesting.
of us who read inspection reports, and there's people now playing the game, aren't they? Read the first paragraph and try and guess what the judgment was. And those range from inadequate to outstanding, and
Well,
you can't separate them.
it sort of reminds me of Dennis Sherwood, that Stan, because the point he's made was that when the government decided to change the grading on GCSEs, they actually increased the number of grades. So they therefore there became many more boundaries where, or a few more boundaries where children could be, through one grade or another, might fall into a different grade. And the same is true with Ofsted. They have only 4 grades, but actually there is always a debate around the boundaries on those grades,
Well, when they lost satisfactory, they automatically made a lot of good schools
they did.
because most of those schools that were deemed satisfactory became good
Good.
school
Yes. Well,
statistics.
and
Probably a linguistic point about the word satisfactory, of course, in grammar. Satisfactory is actually regarded as unsatisfactory. You ought to be doing rather better. So
Yes.
I mean, that has bedeviled school reports forever. You know, child goes home with a report. Every single teacher says satisfactory, and the parents give the child a really hard time. Is that the best you can do? You know,
Well,
the word has lost its meaning.
if you remember, we actually changed the word during inspections to sound
Yes.
rather than satisfactory. And when someone tried to explain sound, they said gives cause for satisfaction.
Yeah, and but actually, as you've made the point before, Stan, I think we were on an inspection in Liverpool where
Apologies.
somebody sort of said, "Well, sound being satisfactory," the one of the governors said, "Sound, that's amazing. You know, I mean, sound is really a
In
great thing to
Liverpool,
achieve in
sound is
Liverpool."
made.
You know, and so he said, "A sound ship never sinks." You know, I remember that phrase. You know, so.
Yeah, but it was sound, was it was a colloquialism for brilliant. You know, how things going? Oh, it's sound. So when the school came out of sound overall, the governors were thrilled.
We're jumping around for joy. Neil, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, I took your invitation literally when you said that what caught my eye could be something that made me laugh or cry. And it's not actually anything to do with education, but it's a book I've just finished reading. It's by Sue Black, who is a forensic anthropologist and anatomist. It's called All That Remains, subtitled A Life in Death. And it is an extremely interesting book. It weaves her own life story in with her professional life, and her professional life has dealt mainly with analyzing forensically dead bodies in order to catch murderers, or even in the case of perhaps her most famous investigation, dealing with the war crimes in Kosovo. And the way in which she manages to make this scientifically interesting, interesting from the sort of the forensic point of view, that's to say, in terms of catching criminals, and at the same time, deeply, deeply humane, weaves in this very moving and very sensitive account of life through understanding death better. It's a very hard book to describe, but it is one of the books, let's say, over the last 2 or 3 years that's made the biggest impact on me. It really is a case that you can understand life through death, which is exactly what she's trying to do, without that becoming morbid. I mean, she has a deep respect for the dead bodies that are her life's work in a way that it seems almost to transcend the normal concepts that we have. All I can do is to say it is a profoundly affecting book, and I would strongly recommend it to anyone who has the stomach for the rather gory details
And
that are there.
I tell you, I'll put that an image of that at the end of this video. And I have to say, you've done enough, Neil, to sell it to me. So I'm going to order that. I probably won't recommend it to my wife for a reading when we go to the van in North Wales. But what's caught my eye is again, it's been a bit off study this week, but the picking up on the point Stan made. About the government have announced that they're not going to support the change of grades on inspections, which in effect goes somewhat against the coroner's report following Ruth Perry's death, and or at least they were asked, I think, to consider it, and they've rejected it. Ofsted's currently doing a survey called the Big Listen, and I tried to complete that survey, and. It doesn't ask the questions. It's a very clever survey that actually just gives, in effect, you can only answer by agreeing. You know, for example, do you think it's right that Ofsted inspects for safeguarding? Well, you know, I think I don't know who's going to write. I disagree with that. You know, it's the way that you inspect for safeguarding and the significance of safeguarding in the overall evaluation of the effectiveness of the school that's probably at the heart of it. But you can only make that point in the text section underneath. So we're going to launch next week the alternative Big Listen, and we will obviously share more on social media, and there'll be something in the press about this. So We want to enable the profession to be able to answer some questions that Ofsted's not asked, and also try and get a sense of the level of confidence that people have in the inspector at the moment. And that's not to say that we don't have confidence in it. I think Stan and I are pretty strong supporters of a form of inspection, regular inspection, as a means of improvement. But, you know, I think that there is something lacking in the Big Listen, and we hope that this will be a chance for people to make make their views be known. And I suspect the government will do nothing about it. They've made their point, but again, we feel as though it's worth doing. So there'll be more on that coming next week. So I hope everybody who follows this, the hundreds or so that follow this, will complete the form and let us know their views. Okay, well, anything else? I think we've reached the end. Neil, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating chat. I knew it would be. And I'm doing some work at the moment with Forum Strategy on I've been asked to lead the sort of Education Leaders Executive Network, and I think there's something here. I'd love to try and draw you in if I may. So I will speak to Alice Gregson about that. I think it'd be really fascinating to get your insight working with senior executives, you know, about how they're using data and how they're holding people to account with it, and what does it all mean? So yeah, I'll come back to you in due course. But thank you, Stan.
Yeah.
We're on again
Hopefully, mine
next
gets
week.
better.
Well, I hope so. I think I'm gonna have to go to the doctors with it, to be honest. It's just trying to deal with it myself, but it's just getting worse. So anyway. So you can all look forward to seeing either Frank with a patch next week or Frank with a better eye. So until next week, thank you, Neil. Thank you, Stan. See you then.
Thanks, Neil. Cheers.
Bye bye. Bye.
Bye.